A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights probably gone.
So had the stairs.
You are just number six.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 87. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are continuing our discussion of The Day After Tomorrow, also known as Into Infinity. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
So this was a live-action Gerry Anderson production from 1975, a 50-minute pilot that was going to be a more extended series, but only this one episode was made.
And it's Gerry Anderson, as you say, famous for his model work and his puppet shows or Super Marination shows. And here he is doing a mainly live-action show, but with obviously a lot of model and special effect work that was intended to introduce concepts of Einsteinian science to its audience of children. So it was an attempt to mix lots of hard science with some science fiction from the mid-70s. And as you say, was intended to go on to a longer series, Brian.
Yes, but even this one episode, which was called Into Infinity, did some interesting things with the science, in particular with Einsteinian science. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Okay, so yes, we're going to see some scientific concepts actually demonstrated on screen as we go along with the story. So as we mentioned last time, the crew of the ship Altares sets off towards Alpha Centauri using their photon drive to achieve near light speed speeds. So we get to see the Doppler shift as the ship leaves our solar system, and as it passes the planet Pluto, we see it first of all blue as they approach the planet, and then as they go past it, it shifts nicely to red and disappears into the wake of the spaceship.
Yes, and they had a very nice little moment about that there. We also have a lot with the crew talking about time dilation effects. And as they are approaching the speed of light, and this crew, as we talked about last time, is two families. There are a couple of kids and a few adults. And they are approaching the speed of light. So they experience, we think, only maybe a few days or so in this spaceship. But for Earth, 30 years of time passes. And they talk about the issues of that quite a bit and what's happening at home, that everyone would be so much older and so on. They also go on to have like a decision point in the story where they are at Alpha Centauri. They have done this process of the near light speed travel, and they have a decision point being there on the front line. Do they go home and report everything back right away? Or do they continue on out into the galaxy and see what else is out there? So there are some interesting things in there, and they're definitely thinking about these time dilation issues and these kinds of things a lot in that process.
Yeah, they had, I mean, a lot of fun with it. As you say, they arrive at Alpha Centauri fairly quickly for the crew. And is it, as you said, 30 years have passed on Earth, they reckon, at that point?
I believe it's 30 years or more, yes.
Yeah. And as you say, Brian, the crew then have to make a decision as to whether to go on or to turn back. And perhaps not surprisingly, given the context of the show and the need for further exploration and adventure, they do decide to carry on. And they're going to come across various other little bits of science and adventure as they proceed. In particular, they will encounter a collapsing star, and they even call it a red giant, which is about to go supernova. And that presents some hazard and adventure for the crew to deal with.
Yes, absolutely. And they show lots of images of looking out at this red giant and seeing their scanning equipment showing things about the red giant. So there were interesting things there and talking about supernovas with it. And, of course, as they proceed, they talk about black holes as well, and looking at what happens and the event horizon of a black hole, light curving around a black hole, these types of things. And they also talk about this idea of a rotating black hole that could act as a gateway to a different part of the universe, or even to a new universe altogether. And they do things with that. That was actually based, it wasn't Einsteinian, it was based on a theory from the 1960s from a different physicist, but they dealt with some of those kinds of things too, and that was really quite neat.
Yeah, they do have fun with it. I mean, as you say, we get this rather nice shot of them firing a laser out of the front of the ship, and then actually seeing the laser beam curve round, obviously affected by the gravitational pull of the black hole. So they do these things, and I'm not sure if we'd have heard much about black holes on television and in science fiction shows by this time in the mid-70s. Possibly one of the first shows to sort of actually get into this sort of science and put it up on the screen. So very interesting stuff.
I think they had been dealt with earlier in some films and things, but this was one of the more serious ones, I think, in talking about how they worked and that sort of thing.
Okay.
It was an interesting approach.
So as you say, they've got all this science up on screen, but they also need some adventure and some sort of events to keep our attention. So they have to put some other bits and pieces into the story for us, Brian.
Yes, and of course they try to use these scientific type things to build in some adventure into it. So you have meteor showers, and you know, they talk about the effects and the velocities of things with meteor showers. They have stars and getting caught with gravity and so on, and black holes. And they also have things about failing equipment and malfunctioning equipment and the drive systems having problems. Well, what are the consequences? How quickly do you need to repair a drive system, and issues related to that? And some of those were quite fun.
Yeah, we see the captain, Harry Masters, having to suit up and go into the engine room to try and repair the photon drive, which is a rather sort of hazardous occupation, and introduces some drama and some time constraints for the crew to deal with.
Yes, there is a lot of heat involved in standing right over these engines, which I thought was a nice touch. In a lot of sci-fi shows, you don't have things like that being involved, and you did here, and that was nice.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And as I say, it keeps the crew occupied and them trying to figure out how they're going to solve these various crises, and also having to work out where they are in the universe at various points and deal with these sort of cosmic events like the star collapsing and going supernova and so on.
Space-time coordinates are gone.
Gone? That's great. So now we've got no idea how long we've been unconscious or how far we've traveled.
But at least the life support systems are working.
Well, that's something. Tom, can you get a fix on our position?
I can't do it, Skipper. The computer can't recognize any of the stars out there.
That's impossible. It'd mean we're off course by billions of miles.
That's right.
What about Space Beacon Delta? Couldn't we get a fix on that?
How about it, Tom?
We could try. But finding that beacon is like hunting for a needle in a billion haystacks. Now, I've got to face it, Skipper, we're lost.
So we should mention Gerry Anderson again. We've talked about him quite a lot on British Invaders, one of the sort of big figures on British television science fiction from the 60s, 70s and 80s. We talked about him way back in episodes 20 and 21 of British Invaders when we discussed the show UFO, another live-action show with lots of model work and special effects, and quite famous for its purple wigs, which we had a lot of fun with at the time, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. That was from about 1970 or so. And we talked about Gerry Anderson again in episodes 65 and 66 when we covered Thunderbirds, which was earlier from the mid-60s, and that was Gerry Anderson's most popular super marionation or marionette puppet-based show. And that was also something that was a very big deal as a children's sci-fi show at the time, both in the UK and over in the States.
Yeah, and he's perhaps best known for those puppet shows, which we mention again and again, the super marionettes and the amazing model work that goes with them. As you say, Thunderbirds, perhaps his best known show, but other key shows from the same sort of time period, Captain Scarlet and Stingray. But there was many, many others as well.
That's right. He did quite a number of super marionation shows. sort of created his own genre, which is quite unusual.
Yeah.
But he also wanted to do live action productions to go along with this and still be able to use some model work for spaceships and that sort of thing, but to have live action human actors to go with that. And he had a film that he was involved with called Doppelganger, also known as Journey to the Far Side of the Sun, that he did some of the production work on, but I don't think he was involved with the model work and that sort of thing. That was in about 1969. But he also had a couple of live-action TV series, UFO, that we mentioned earlier in about 1969-70, broadcast in starting 1970. And he went on to do Space 1999, which I would argue was also one of his key works, because Space 1999 was a very popular and successful show, both in the UK and in the States as well. So that was quite a big deal.
Yeah, so he has an enormous body of work. As you say, Brian, almost created his own genre and the puppet stuff. And I think it's fair to say that this won't be the last time we're discussing a Gerry Anderson show on British Invaders. He's probably going to come up again in the future, Brian.
I think that's a fair guess.
So he must have had quite high hopes for this live-action project, working with NBC Television in America, producing this show The Day After Tomorrow. You know, he always wanted to do more live-action stuff. And initially, it must have seemed like this was going to be a very well-funded American sort of funded show produced by this British team. But unfortunately, as we've said, it was only the one episode ever made and didn't succeed. And it's rather disappeared for the last 35 years or so, Brian.
Yes, I think Anderson's dealings with the American networks were very much a mixed bag. He got a lot of support and a lot of broadcasts from them, but they seemed to disappear quite quickly. As with Thunderbirds, it was a big deal in the States for a couple of years, and it looked like it was going to become an even bigger deal, and there was a bidding war over it, and then all of a sudden support just dropped right out and the series ended.
Yeah.
And I suspect something was a little bit similar for this one.
Yes, it's a shame in a way. It would be interesting to see where they would have gone with this science-based show and what would have happened with the spaceship Altaris and its crew, but we can only sort of speculate.
Yes, they were talking about doing a run of 6 or 7 episodes or something like that, and maybe it would have come back even after that. But, yeah, it only was produced for this one, of course.
Okay. So we should talk about the highlights and the lowlights of the this show, The Day After Tomorrow, and the bits we liked and the bits we didn't like quite so much. Brian, what would you like to pick out first on the good side?
Well, for me, I absolutely loved how the science was handled in this. It was front and center. It came up many times in the space of a 50-minute show, and had some detail, and it was working with these modern Einsteinian ideas that were 20th century, and that was really nice.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's extremely well done, and they managed to get an awful lot of science up on screen while at the same time keeping the action and adventure going for us and keep us entertained as well. So they handled it very well indeed. We should also mention the model work, which from Gerry Anderson's team is pretty well perfect by this stage, I think, in their productions. And so it does look very impressive. The space station Delta and the Altaris itself traveling through space looks very good. Very similar, I guess, to the look of Space 1999, because as you said before, many of the models were reused for that show or borrowed from that show.
Yes, it does have quite a good look to it. The space shots tend to be quite static, but that's sort of its time, and it's also fairly realistic in how they were showing it, because you would expect them to be sort of static in that way for these sort of long straight line journeys. But yeah, the look was very good. I liked the look of the sets and costumes, how it was set up. It definitely had a similar feel to Space 1999. Parts of it also reminded me a little bit of the early Star Trek movies that started coming out a few years later, Star Trek 1, Star Trek 2, that sort of thing, with how the set on the inside of the ship was done and some of those types of things.
Right. Oh, okay. Yeah, it's interesting to compare the two. because we talked about Star Trek when we discussed UFO and how, you know, it was quite similar, although certainly there were similar themes there or similar concepts in Star Trek on the TV show and then Gerry Anderson's UFO show over here in Britain.
Yes.
That's an interesting comparison. What about the cast and the acting performances here, Brian?
Oh, I enjoyed them. There were a lot of understated performances, surprisingly so from Brian Blessed. The performances generally were pretty good. One of the standouts for me was Catherine Levy, who was playing the daughter, the young girl in this. And as we mentioned last time, she went on to be the daughter in Children of the Stones. And even after that, she was actually in Robin of Sherwood at one point. And she was a very good young actress. And the couple of moments where she had to be very emotional and it was sort of more sort of big acting, it was okay. She did it pretty well. But some of the more understated things that she did were really very nice. There was a moment when they did the thing with the Doppler effect and passing Pluto, and she looks out the window at Pluto as it changes to red with the Doppler effect as they're passing it, and you look back at her and she's saying, you know, goodbye to Pluto and to the solar system, and it was a really nice little emotional moment there.
Yeah, she is very good. Here she is doing a slight American accent, as compared to a normal British-speaking voice in Children of the Stones. But she's, you know, she's well worth watching in this show, as she is in Children of the Stones, another fantastic show that we've discussed before on British Invaders.
Yes.
And, you know, we have a small cast here. I think we only have six actors in all, but they're all pretty good, and there's no problems with any of the performances. You know, perhaps Brian Blessed slightly underplaying things, but that's an interesting variation for him. We do like Brian Blessed when he gets a bit loud and shouty, but that's not going to happen in this show.
Yes, the young boy in this was probably the weakest link, but he was okay. You know, he was not terrible by any means. Once you mention the accents, Nick Tate, I guess, was Australian but doing an American accent, which was a little odd, but actually it was not a terrible accent. It was not perfect, but it was okay. But having his daughter, who is basically speaking with a British accent, but picking up little bits of his American accent, especially when she was talking about him and thinking about him, that was interesting. I thought that was nicely used and just sort of subtly put in there.
So, you know, the actors are very good. The production look of the show is very good. We like the model work and the special effects. We especially like the science up there on screen. I suppose we did notice that it does, at times, the action stalls a little bit and they have to introduce some crises for the crew to deal with. In particular, I think the episode where the photon, or the part of the show where the photon drive fails and Captain Masters has to put the big heat suit on to travel into the engine room and actually deal with that.
That sequence was actually pretty well done.
It was, yes. I mean, they, you know, it was well done, and it does give you this sense of tension as they're, you know, he's approaching the limit of how long he can stay in there. Meanwhile, the ship's being dragged down towards the supernova, so it's all very good.
And his daughter is having to deal with this as well at the same time.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. I think the weak point in this, and the biggest weak point, the only obvious weak point that I can see, would definitely be plot, in that this is kind of light on the plot side. There is not a lot of strong story element. And it tends to be about, you know, this is their journey and this is what they're doing, and they're dealing with the different issues that come along.
Yeah, I mean, without giving away the ending, it did set up for there to be plenty more stories, if possible, about the crew of the starship Altares. But unfortunately, as we've said, then we never got to find out what those stories would be, which I guess is one of the negative points of this, to the fact that there is only one episode and we never got the rest of it.
Yes, it would have been nice to see a few more of these for sure. So I guess that is a weakness, that they only just did the one 50-minute episode.
And it's probably therefore one of the shortest things we've looked at on British Invaders. It's only 50 minutes long. Most of the shows we've talked about have been longer than that, even the standalone ones. And it's possibly, as a result, as we're about to find out, possibly one of the most expensive things we've looked at on British Invaders so far, Brian.
Yes, I think certainly for something that is just one single disc, one single DVD, and is still available, is not out of print, it is quite pricey. So that brings us nicely into the availability issues for this. It was actually released by the official Gerry Anderson fan club. The fan club is called Fanderson. You can find them at fanderson.org.uk. And they did a DVD release, and it is an official licensed DVD release that is available from Fanderson.
And you have to be a member of Fanderson to get hold of it. And membership will cost you £27 here in the UK. But that rises to £32 for Europe and £38 for the rest of the world. You get a membership pack and a one-year subscription to the Fanderson magazine, which is called FAB, and I think comes out quarterly, full of information about all the various Gerry Anderson shows and interviews with the creators and the actors who appeared in them over the years. And then once you're a member, you can order this officially licensed DVD from them, and that will then cost you another £13 here in the UK, which again rises in Europe to £14 and £16 for the rest of the world. So that's on top of your membership.
Does that include the shipping? Is that why you have the different prices?
I believe that's right, yes. I think shipping was included in that.
So what you're looking at is something that runs, depending where you are, from around £40 up to around £54, which is... pretty expensive for a single disc DVD, for sure. Although, as you said, it does come with a few other things with the membership. The disc itself is double-sided. It's an all-regions DVD, or Region Zero DVD, if you like. And one side has the show in the European PAL resolution, and the other side of the disc has the show in the North American NTSC resolution. So this is an international disc that the same disc can be played anywhere. It should work on just about any DVD player anywhere in the world. It also does include a second show. So you're not just getting one 50-minute episode on this disc. You're actually getting two 50-minute episodes on this disc. The second one is another Gerry Anderson show called Space Police.
Yes, you get this extra bit called Space Police, which has the actor Shane Rimmer appearing in this pilot episode for, as you say, a show called Space Police, about an orbital police station and their interactions with various alien races. And the alien races are mostly done by puppets or by actors wearing very strange masks. And it would eventually go on to change and become the show Space Precinct, which again has the same theme of live actors interacting with puppets and people wearing masks on an orbital space station or police station. Now, I've watched Space Police, the pilot show, and I have to say it is rather poor quality. The actor Shane Rimmer is doing his best, but he's struggling with these rather dodgy puppets around him and these various models and actors wearing rather inexpressive alien masks. So it's a tricky show to watch.
Yeah, so that disc is actually a double feature with these two different episodes, but really it's The Day After Tomorrow Into Infinity is the one that you want to look at.
Yeah. There's a few other bits on there, some production stills from both shows included as well, but that's pretty much it. And as far as we know, it's not available anywhere else. You have to get it through Fanderson in order to track down this show and watch The Day After Tomorrow.
Yes, that's right.
The crew are docking. What dangers will they face when they take this first giant leap into the unknown? For the first stage of their mission, they will journey to Alpha Centauri, the nearest star to our own solar system, a mere 24 million million miles from Earth. Einstein's time dilation effect could create immense human problems for the crew. On their return, they could find that 30 years may have elapsed, while they will have been away for only a fraction of
time. So that brings us to our recommendations. Maybe I'll go first this time.
Okay, Brian, what did you think?
I really enjoyed this. As we said, it was a little low on plot and story, but for a 50-minute show, that was okay, considering everything that it did have in it. The science things in it were wonderful. I really enjoyed seeing how they did that. The cast was good. There were some emotional moments and performances that I really quite enjoyed in this, especially from Kathryn Levy, but from others as well. And you had a nice sort of slick look to it, then some neat things going on, and it's something that is very different. I haven't seen anything quite like this, even though it does share a lot in its look with things like Space 1999. But all in all, it's a really fun, neat little show to watch that has some very clever things in it. So I will definitely recommend this, with the only caveat being the price. Unfortunately, it is rather expensive.
Yeah, I think it's a good show as well. I enjoyed it. I'm a great fan of all Gerry Anderson's productions, and I really like this little show, The Day After Tomorrow. I just wished it could have gone on longer and we could have seen more of their adventures if the pilot had been picked up, but sadly that never happened. The only problem, as you say, Brian, is the price. It is very expensive to get hold of and watch this show, and I suspect it's really only for the Gerry Anderson completist. And if you are a Gerry Anderson completist, you've probably got this disc already. If you're looking to sort of get some to watch some Gerry Anderson shows and you haven't seen his work before, then you're probably going to find other things to look at first, which are cheaper and you get more for your money. Shows like UFO and Thunderbirds and Space 1999. But it's a fun show. We enjoyed watching Day After Tomorrow. I even enjoyed watching Space Police, although that's more on the so bad it's good sort of enjoyment level.
Indeed. And these two episodes are unusual in that they're short-run, one-off things where most of Gerry Anderson's productions, if you want to watch the whole series, there's actually quite a bit there.
So it's a cautious double recommendation from us here on British Invaders. And as ever, we'd like to know what you think. If you've had the opportunity to watch The Day After Tomorrow, please come and join us on Facebook and let us know what you felt, what you thought about it.
Absolutely. Please let us know by Facebook or email. We'd love to hear some comments about this show, which is a little obscure. It hasn't been seen all that much. So, in summary, The Day After Tomorrow, or Into Infinity, was a 1975 Gerry Anderson production that had a look that was similar to Space 1999 and dealt with a group of people, two families, on the lightship Altares traveling to Alpha Centauri and beyond and exploring the galaxy and finding new things with lots of Einsteinian physics and other current and fairly modern elements of physics involved.
It's a fun little show from Gerry Anderson. Do let us know if you've had the chance to watch him.
Absolutely.
And please come back and join us next time on British Invaders, when we're going to be watching a show that's a lot easier to get hold of and gives you more bang for your buck. We're going to 1997 and the BBC for a show called Crime Traveller, which is a fun time-travelling detective show with lots of mystery and entertainment and quite a romp, Brian.
Yes, time-travelling cops, fun stuff.
Absolutely.
So you can reach us at britishinvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.britishinvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you go to Facebook and search for British Invaders, you will find us there. So thank you for listening. This is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. Until next time, this is Eamon from England, saying into infinity and beyond.